Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Overall, yesterday's state primary voting seems to have gone pretty well, despite new pandemic-related precautions at the polls and an unprecedented number of absentee ballots. Today in The Exchange, we review Tuesday's elections and look ahead to November. And Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. How did voting go in your town? If you used an absentee ballot, what was your experience? And we'd like your reactions, of course, to the results as well, now that most party nominees have been chosen. Join us with an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org, or use Facebook, or give us a call. It's 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director, Andy Smith, professor of practice in the Department of Political Science at UNH and director of the UNH Survey Center, also NHPR's Casey McDermott, who's been tracking all the issues surrounding voting this year. A big welcome to all of you. I know you were up late last night. Casey, let's start with you. How large was the increase in absentee voting yesterday? Do we have a sense of that yet, Casey?
So we don't have final numbers yet, but what we do know is that at the start of this week, as of Monday morning, the Secretary of State's office said 75,000 absentee ballots had already been returned. So that's before the election even, you know, opened up at the polls. And that also didn't account for any ballots that were returned on Monday during that special, session where people could bring them back to their clerk's offices. It also didn't count any absentee ballots that may have been dropped off at the polls yesterday, which is something that people could do as well. So to put that into perspective, it's going to be a pretty big increase no matter what, because that 75,000 absentee ballot number was at least 8 times as many absentee ballots as were cast in the same election in 2016.
Wow. So we don't have final numbers yet, but we can definitively say, Casey, yes, it was a lot. Just to remind us of why so many people voted absentee this year and how the state made it so much easier.
Sure. So, you know, in the past, New Hampshire has resisted, or, you know, state officials at the top have resisted expansions of absentee voting, or kind of no excuses absentee voting, as it's sometimes called. That's something that exists in a number of other states, but here in New Hampshire, you know, there've been efforts to change it, and those have been largely, rebuffed at the kind of highest levels of state leadership. However, early on in the pandemic, state officials made very clear that any voter in New Hampshire could cast an absentee ballot if they were concerned about COVID-19, which essentially set up a kind of no excuses absentee voting scenario, which a lot of people took advantage of, as we're seeing. I'm curious to see the final partisan breakdown of how many Republicans voted absentee versus how many Democrats. However, we do see people across the political spectrum who made use of it, people across, you know, age ranges. We heard from a number of voters at NHPR who said that they welcomed this change. We also heard from a number of people who still showed up at the polls too. So it seems like, you know, Granite Staters really made use of all of their options this year, it would seem.
Well, one of the changes that I thought was interesting, Casey, maybe you can explain this a little bit more, is people had concerns about the mail, you know, all the politicking around that in Washington, and just broader concerns that what if my ballot doesn't get there in time? So the state made it possible for people to drop off their absentee ballot at the polls. So how did that work, Casey? That's new.
Yeah, so I should say, for the most part, from what we're hearing at this stage, and this could change, but at this stage, it sounds like things went pretty smoothly yesterday. But where there was a little bit of an issue was around that change. We noticed actually at NHPR early on yesterday that there were a handful of town websites that were still mistakenly telling people that they couldn't drop off their absentee ballots to election officials at their polling place. And we reached out to the state to ask about it just to make sure to clarify the process as we understood it. And the state actually issued a memo yesterday morning to all local election officials to remind them that they should be accepting those absentee ballots being dropped off at the polling place on election day. So that's one change that did have, you know, a little bit of kind of a hiccup, but it sounds like that was resolved relatively quickly. But, you know, I think it was probably a reminder that there are a number of changes this year. And if there's the potential for problems, often that comes down to kind of differences in how those changes are communicated, or just making sure that everyone, poll workers, the public, the press, even, is on the same page about how people can cast a vote and how the process works. So we actually talked to the AG's office yesterday, and they said that they plan to do more training specifically on some of those absentee ballot deadline procedures to make sure that that process is improved for November.
Well, lots of comments on NHPR's blog about elections, and I'll be sharing those throughout the hour. It's really great to hear people's experiences, what it was like, what questions they had around voting. David in Nashua says, I voted by mail for the first time. I received my ballot last Tuesday, dropped it off at the Nashua clerk's office Friday. Easy, no line, says David in Nashua. Richard and Sandra in Madbury says, we voted by absentee ballot last week. We hand-delivered our ballots to a nice young lady at the walk-up window at Madbury Town Hall. Could not have been easier. So those are just a couple comments from our blog about voters' experiences yesterday. Andy Smith, prior to the election, we did hear lots of concerns from voters about absentee ballots. What does that reflect, Andy, on just how Americans are feeling this year about confusion and the mechanisms we have for our democracy?
Well, I think there's the whole process of voting has been politicized over the last couple decades as to who can vote and who can't vote, and different strategies that parties have taken to either increase or decrease voting that might benefit their political party's chances. So I think that this got swept up into that, and we saw it in some of our polling that Democrats were far more supportive of being able to choose to vote absentee during COVID-19 than Republicans were, although Republicans seem to have come around to this, as Casey indicated. I think there'll probably be more Democrats in vote absentee than Republicans. But the politicization of all aspects of voting is something that really kind of troubling to me. Although in New Hampshire, we have never really had an issue with concerns about fraudulent voting or concerns about absentee voting. And I should make a point that it's absentee voting is very different than voting by mail, and that you still have to go and request from your town clerk to get that absentee ballot, and you have to sign it. Whereas voting by mail, they come to you at your home, whether you want it or not, or whether you live there or not. So there are some differences there that have been blurred between absentee voting and mail voting.
Oh, that's a really important distinction. Thank you for pointing that out, Andy. And I'm just curious, as a voter, Andy, did you choose absentee or did you actually go to the polls yesterday?
I actually went to the polls because I just wanted to see what the process was.
Yeah. What was it like?
It was a little bit slower, but there were fewer people at the polls. So I think that many people took advantage of the absentee ballot, which made it kind of lighter for the rest of us. However, because of the COVID procedures, it kind of slowed things down with how ballots were handed to you and how you could put them in, and putting your pen into the used pen jar and all of the other little things that went along with it. But I think overall it was pretty interesting. It was much less enthusiastic though, because you didn't have the same electioneering going on outside as you would typically see, people talking with folks holding signs as they're walking in because of the social distancing. That just didn't happen as much. And Durham, obviously, is a town that typically has some of the highest turnout in the state.
Wow. Well, we're going to hear later from the town manager in Durham more about the mechanics of voting and how that went in your hometown, Andy. Regarding the politicization that you mentioned around voting mechanisms, Fred in Canterbury wrote on our blog, here's a concern. There's increasing discussion of, quote, what if Trump appears to be losing and refuses to accept the result and takes drastic action? Fred says, I would like to see no election night predicted results by the media until every last absentee ballot has been counted nationwide. Fred says, we can't afford another Florida 2000 or worse. And then we just got an email from Jerry in Concord, who also wants to know about the counting. Jerry asks, when are absentee ballots counted? I seem to recall that in the past, i.e. before the pandemic, absentee ballots were often tabulated after the media reported the results as final. Great question, Jerry. And Casey, can you clarify that, please?
Sure. So one of the things that I've heard made the process go so smoothly yesterday was the fact that a number of communities were allowed to start pre-processing. So this isn't counting, but pre-processing absentee ballot paperwork earlier than they might normally pre-COVID. So what that means is that poll workers in different communities, if they you know, sufficiently publicized that they plan to do this, could start, you know, reviewing the absentee ballot envelopes, could start making sure that they had the right signatures, could flag any issues potentially to follow up with the voter who submitted that absentee ballot paperwork so that that person had an opportunity to potentially correct it. And what I heard was that that cut down on some of the processing time that might have otherwise kind of delayed things in reporting out the results yesterday. Again, yeah, it's still early and we may still take some time to hear, you know, how things went on kind of a community level in the days and weeks ahead as everyone sorts through things. But, you know, for the most part, it sounds like that was helpful to a lot of people. And then it's also important to note that the way absentee ballots are counted in New Hampshire, the ballots get put into the ballot box, into the ballot counting machine, along with any other ballot. So there's no distinction when they're actually counted as to whether they're an absentee ballot or a, you know, a ballot that someone filled out inside a voting booth. So that's also important for people to know. But to the larger point about trust in the results and perceptions around who's winning and who's losing and whether people can be confident in that, one of the things that we're trying to do in at NHPR is to really explain the process to people start to finish. So we did a detailed voter guide on our website leading up to the primary. We'll continue to update that with people's questions leading up to the general. And we also want to make sure, you know, we're in touch pretty routinely with local election officials. We try to reach out to state election officials as much as possible to make sure that we're understanding the process so that we can do our part as the media to explain to people, here's what to expect, and to also make clear that if you see a delay, that doesn't mean that something is wrong. That means that people are, you know, generally taking the time to count things correctly.
Dan Barrick, what did you hear from listeners? Your team was out in the field all day yesterday and has been covering these voting issues all along. So I'd love to get some feedback from you, too, on how it went yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it was largely in line with some of the comments you read earlier from folks who wrote into us. The polls themselves were fairly quiet on Election Day because of, I think, a lot of the people choosing the absentee ballot route. A lot of folks seemed really satisfied and impressed with the precautions being taken at the polls, the use of plexiglass and, you know, signage and clear moving people through. And even, you know, several people commented on the take-home pens that people were given to fill out the ballots, little things like that. So I think, you know, in both in terms of what, you know, carrying out what seems to have been a careful and safe, you know, sort of socially distanced election, I think it went a long way towards reassuring folks who, you know, heading into this, we had no idea how an election under these terms would be carried out, which I think is great heading into November. Of course, we'll be expecting bigger turnout in November, as is the case for most general elections. And, you know, of course, and during a party primary, the opportunity for, you know, more partisan challenges and refutations of results is a lot higher. And I think that's something, you know, we'll be trying to understand what the state, how the state's preparing for that, how the candidates and the parties are preparing for that. But by and large, I mean, I think folks, both what we heard in the field talking to people who were voting at their local polling place and hearing online from folks who decided to vote absentee, largely with a handful of exceptions, people felt quite satisfied and safe and secure in how the election was carried out.
Oh, that's interesting what you said, Dan, there for a moment. Give us a little more, please. The idea that, you know, if there were disputes over counting or numbers, you know, they're going to be smaller in a primary where people are at least voting within party than in a general election where it's a little more heated. Is that what you're saying there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, those eruptions tend to break down along party lines more often than not, which is not to say it's not, you know, it's not possible
sure.
for two candidates within a primary to dispute the results. I mean, we're actually seeing one candidate now not conceding in a race that's been called. But I think given the stakes, you know, we've got a presidential election nationally, and then, you know, big statewide races in New Hampshire. I do think some of the things we were trying to understand last night, as Casey mentioned, is like, you know, so what is the absentee ballot processing and counting process look like? That is an opportunity where, you know, people can bring challenges to those ballots, seeing how that plays out in November and getting a better understanding of what the state and local election officials' plans are for ensuring a smooth process there is something we're really going to be trying to understand and explain to folks heading into November.
We got a comment from a listener on Twitter who says, spent much of the day outside my town polling station. One man claimed he couldn't wear a mask, and the moderator stepped outside to allow him to check in and vote. Firm and fair, that person says. We got a couple other comments from listeners on our blog, most of whom were very satisfied with how it went yesterday. Melissa in Milford says, it's been a breeze to vote in Milford. This was no exception. There was a booth behind the registration table that gave us a mat to put down under our ballots and a pen. There's that pen you just mentioned. They did not have the usual curtain doors on the booth, but they were blocked off on either side. We were told to throw away the paper mat and we could toss it or either keep the pen. There was hand sanitizer at the entrance and the exit. Steve in Amherst also says in-person voting was very easy here in Amherst. They had lines easily marked out. Everyone wore a mask. Steve says, I like the ballot cover sheet issued to us to mark the ballot and place in the ballot counter. Nice touch, says Steve. But then we've got a comment from Jeanette in Manchester who says, I hope they put safety measures in place before the November elections. The staff were protected, but people were exiting and entering through the same doors. There were no distances marked on the floor. No one official was at the entrance requesting face covering. It was uncomfortable and disappointing. I expected better. So that's from Jeanette in Manchester. And then, Casey, I want to ask you about a pair of comments that I've got here. I won't read all of them, but Roy in Concord and Eric in Hanover both had trouble finding their new polling places. Some wards did have to change where they were going to actually do the voting because they needed a larger space for social distancing purposes. So Roy in Concord, for example, says he first went to the normal polling location to find it locked, no sign of anybody. He used his phone to find the poll location had moved. So he had some trouble with that. And then Eric in Hanover says, voting was smooth for me today in Hanover. Once I found the new polling place, our polling place had moved, but many people did not know that. So Casey, what about that? You know, polling places move and people are in the habit. I know I'm in the habit of going to the same place every 2 years. So I'm just wondering what you're hearing there.
Yeah, that's actually, that's a really good point. And that's something that I would just encourage voters to make sure that they're doing their homework ahead of the election to avoid any of those election day surprises, as it were. We are going to see more changes likely. Some places are looking to have different polling locations for the general in November than they used in September. So again, I would just advise people to be extra vigilant, check in with your town clerk, check the Secretary of State's website because there's a polling place lookup on there where you can type in your address and see, you know, where you should go to cast your vote on election day if that's what you're choosing to do. So again, it's just going to be really, really important for people to, we often hear this from campaigns on both sides of the aisle, make a plan to vote. It's really good advice just in general, just if you want to be, you know, a civic participant in the elections, and especially this year, because there are so many changes in the process because of COVID-19.
We got an email from Patrice who says Canterbury ran out of Democratic ballots yesterday, which means the photocopied ballots needed to be counted by hand, slowing the count. Patrice says, was this a common issue? And how does the Secretary of State's office decide how many ballots to provide? Why not just provide ballots for each party, for each registered voter? Casey, I'd love to hear from you on this, but also you, Andy Smith. But go ahead, Casey.
Yeah, so I've not heard of other issues like that, but that doesn't mean that they didn't happen. It just may be that, you know, poll workers were pretty busy yesterday resolving those issues on the spot and may not have reached out to us. But that does come up from time to time, like if there's more turnout than expected. My understanding is that the state, you know, goes off of kind of a combination of how many voters turned out in past elections and other kind of factors to figure out how many ballots to send each community. But that was something that came up before the election. People were wondering, you know, what if we do run out of ballots, and that the state had a plan in place or had some kind of process, because this has happened before. It's not something new, to make sure that they can get the ballots in, or to make sure that there are other ways to resolve the issue on election day if it comes up.
And Andy, what did we see yesterday in terms of people requesting Democratic ballots or Republican ballots? There were competitive primaries on both sides.
You know, it's a little hard to say right now because we don't have the final numbers in, but it was somewhat surprising to me that Republican turnout looks to be about as high as Democratic turnout. So the Democrats had certainly the competitive primary for the governor's race, but the Republicans had not only a competitive primary for the Senate race, but both congressional districts. So it tells me that looking forward towards November, that both parties seem to be about equally enthusiastic as we're going forward, because usually political scientists look at turnout in primary elections, state primary elections, as kind of a gauge, not a perfect gauge, but a gauge of enthusiasm looking towards a general election in November.
Well, and last question for you, Casey, about November, given the experience yesterday, both at the polls and absentee voting, what are some lessons learned for the big one coming up later this fall?
I think making sure that the public has the information that they need to understand the process is going to be really key. I think the other thing that we're going to want to keep an eye on is, you know, as Dan said, things appear to have run relatively smoothly, but it was a primary. The stakes are higher for everyone in the general because it's, you know, party control of a number of different offices at a number of different levels. So that's where I think we would be likely to see, if any, more, you know, issues emerge over, you know, challenges to ballots or other things that may arise during the day. And New Hampshire's races at the top of the ticket in 2016 were rather close. So I think that parties are going to be really, watching the results and watching the voting process very closely to, you know, ensure that their, you know, campaigns and parties are, our interests are reflected there. So I think that's going to be something to watch as well. And again, with the, you know, some of the concerns that we've heard around the Postal Service, I think that people, you know, that was something that we heard pop up a little bit. We didn't hear of widespread issues, but as we get closer to November, you know, that's something that I will certainly be keeping an eye on, is are people getting the paperwork that they need? Is it getting back in time? Are there any concerns with deadlines? You know, things of that nature.
Wow. Lots for you to keep track of, Casey. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's NHPR's Casey McDermott. She has been covering the mechanics and processes around voting for us at NHPR. Coming up, more on yesterday's voting, and we'll look ahead to November. We'll look at some of the races, how they turned out. We'll talk about that still undecided race for the Democratic nomination for governor, as Dan Barrick told us. Dan Feltes has declared victory, but Andrew Walensky has not yet conceded. And we'll also talk to Matt Mowers. He's the newly minted Republican nominee in New Hampshire's 1st District. All that plus your questions and comments, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a review of Tuesday's elections and looking ahead. Exchange listeners, if you voted in person or absentee yesterday, tell us your experience. How did it go? And what do you make of the results in some key primaries, like that Democratic contest for governor or the Republican primary for U.S. Senate? Send us an email. Tell us what you think. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking this hour with NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and UNH professor and pollster Andy Smith. And with us now for a few minutes is Matt Mowers. He's the new Republican nominee for the 1st Congressional District. And Mr. Mowers, thank you for being with us after, I'm sure, a very busy day. To what do you attribute your victory in the primary?
Well, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, it's just really humbling to have such overwhelming support in yesterday's election. And now to be able to go on to run in November against Chris Pappas. And, you know, I really attribute this victory to a few different things. First and foremost is our message, the fact that we need to fight for the middle class and have a representative of the middle class down Washington, D.C. again. The fact that we need someone who's going to stand by law enforcement and work with them so that they have the tools necessary to keep our communities safe. Someone's going to work with small businesses to put partisan politics aside and actually get things done for them, especially in times like a global pandemic like we saw, you know, this past year. As well as then, I also believe we just ran this the New Hampshire way. It was a strong grassroots campaign. I mean, our teams knocked on over 100,000 doors throughout the primary process, and we're looking forward to taking that organization now to ensuring that we win in November, too.
Oh, that's interesting. You knocked on 100,000 doors, and that sounds so wonderfully old-fashioned. What was it like campaigning in a pandemic?
Well, look, you know, we were fortunate that we had some tremendous supporters. So even when things were shutting down, we, you know, first and foremost, we made sure that we were there for our community. You know, my wife, Cassie, and I helped deliver masks for a group that called themselves the Bedford Sewing Battalion. They were making homemade masks for frontline workers. And we helped deliver some of those. So that was important, of course. But then also we shifted our campaign online. We were able to turn our supporters into digital activists and canvassers who shared information, got news out to their neighbors. And then when things reopened, we were able to go back to some more traditional grassroots campaigning in a safe way, you know, making sure folks were wearing masks and gloves and everything else, and got out there and engaged with people who were really interested in hearing what we had to say. You know, a lot of folks out there are concerned about what next steps may have to be taken to confront the COVID-19 response. And, you know, I think they're really grateful, actually, to be able to have that conversation with folks in politics. They have a lot of concerns and they want to ensure that they're voting for someone who's got their values and their interests at heart as well.
Well, and Mr. Mowers, what's your message to the supporters of your primary opponents, especially Matt Mayberry? He was your closest competitor.
Yeah, look, and, you know, Matt and I have been friends for a long time, as we talked about throughout the campaign trail, had a chance to meet the other folks running as well briefly throughout the campaign. Now, we welcome their support. You know, this is going to be all hands on deck to reclaim our seat in Congress from kind of the far left wing and actually return it as a voice for the people of New Hampshire. And so we're going to need everyone's support on that. So I asked for their support and asked them to join the team, and received a really gracious phone call from Matt Mayberry last night, and he pledged his support, and look forward to earning support of all of his supporters as well.
Well, and you don't mean to tell you this, that the 1st District is known as a swing district, more so than the 2nd District. So candidates like you and Mr. Pappas both have to appeal more to the middle, to independents. You can't win this seat by just appealing to the party's base, as I know you know. How are you hoping to approach those more middle-of-the-road voters who may not be in the Republican Party's base of so-called, you know, Trump voters?
Sure. Well, you know, look, folks saw 2 years ago that Chris Pappas campaigned and said he would be independent. He said he would be different. He said he would work across the aisle. He didn't do that. You know, he actually looked in the eyes of Bedford business owners and said he would be an ally for them. And then he turned his back on them. And a lot of those folks are now supporting me. He looked in the eyes of law enforcement, a lot of police unions who endorsed him 2 years ago. But he turned his back to them. They've now recognized it, had buyer's remorse, and are looking for a different direction. So, you know, when we talk about what it's going to take to kind of win the voters in the middle, it's going to be the same message we're talking about. The fact of the matter is that Chris Pappas has turned his back on the people of New Hampshire. He's instead saddled up with the far left of his party. He's voted with Nancy Pelosi 100% of the time. And that's not, you know, the New Hampshire way. You know, the New Hampshire way is that we have strong convictions and strong values, but we're able to get things done. But we need Congress to start delivering for the people again. And unfortunately, Chris Pappas has been part of the congressional swamp down there and hasn't been delivering for the people. He's only been delivering for his party's leadership.
Well, and how does the president's support of your campaign, Mr. Mowers, affect your ability to connect with those more middle-of-the-road voters who might not really like the president?
Well, look, I appreciate the president's support, but at the end of the day, this is an election between myself and Chris Pappas. And what people will know that they can get from me is that when I give them my word, I'll keep it, and that I will fight tirelessly every single day for New Hampshire's middle class, for New Hampshire's law enforcement, for New Hampshire's veterans, for New Hampshire's small business owners. That's my commitment. And so, you know, we've tried this experiment with Chris Pappas 2 years ago. We've now seen that he was willing to say a lot of things to get elected and hasn't delivered. And so, you know, folks are looking for a new alternative, and I look forward to earning their support and earning their trust in these final 8 weeks of this campaign.
Well, and Mr. Mowers, we will look forward to seeing you at the NHPR debates this fall. I know we're putting out invitations, so we'll talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Look forward to chatting with you soon.
That was Matt Mowers, the Republican nominee in the 1st Congressional District. Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we want to know how voting went for you yesterday and also your reaction to some of the results that we saw. And Dan Barrick and Andy Smith, before we go to our listeners, we've got lots of people who want to jump in. Dan, I'd love your thoughts on some of the themes that we heard from Matt Mowers there.
Yeah, I mean, you heard him in a nutshell in that interview, and I think there it's a version of what you're going to be hearing from the Republicans looking to knock off New Hampshire's three incumbent members of the federal delegation up for re-election this year, which is, you know, the claim that Chris Pappas has somehow become distant or turned his back on the district, that he's become captive to Washington. You know, it's going to be seeking to tie Pappas to, you know, what Mowers, I guess, would consider to be the more extreme aspects of Democratic national politics. And you're also going to hear, you know, as you mentioned, Mowers was endorsed by President Trump, and he made a lot of that endorsement in his primary against Matt Maryberry. He'll almost certainly be downplaying that in the general. But, you know, you're going to hear a lot of notes of the same kind of language that the president himself would be using in his own run for reelection, talking up, you know, violence in across the country and essentially really running a national election, trying to nationalize this race against Pappas. You know, you're right. It is a very swing district. Republicans and Democrats have tossed it back and forth almost every other cycle for the last decade. So Mowers does have some history on his side. You know, it'll remain to be seen how much a kind of nationalization of this race might work against someone like Pappas, who, you know, has worked steadily through local politics, is well known in the district, and certainly, you know, his family has longtime ties to the area with their ownership of a popular restaurant in the city. But I think we're going to hear versions of that. This is essentially the same kind of message Corky Mesner will be running as he tries to defeat Jeanne Shaheen in the U.S. Senate race, and that Steve Negron will be campaigning on as he tries to defeat Congresswoman Annie Custer. A nationalization, I think, of essentially taking the same argument that the president is using and bringing it down to the local level here.
And Andy Smith, Mr. Mowers mentioned in that interview his support for law enforcement. I am wondering if this is also a theme that we're going to hear, Andy, time and time again in these races, people sort of drawing some lines around support for law enforcement.
I think you're absolutely going to hear it. The Trump campaign is running essentially a redux of the 1968 Richard Nixon campaign of law and order and the silent majority. And that happened back in 68 in a time of racial unrest, rioting in many cities, assassinations, Martin Luther King, et cetera. And Trump and Republicans are counting on, I don't say a backlash so much as people who are not engaged in the actual protests, seeing the destruction and so forth and saying they don't want to have that here. Certainly this isn't an issue that has directly impacted New Hampshire as much as it has other parts of the country, But to Dan's point, that's the nationalization of campaigns is something that's been really going on since 1994, when Newt Gingrich really tried to nationalize that midterm election. And it's a good spot to be as the two parties have moved further and further apart ideologically, and there are fewer independent voters or moderate voters in the middle. And to nationalize an election, you want to the goal there is to motivate your base as much as you possibly can and get them out to vote at the expense of those middle of the road voters. And despite what Mr. Maurer said, I think that you'll be seeing a lot more of this demonization of the other party as we go forward, because frankly, it's good politics now. It may not be healthy for the country in the long run, but it's good electoral politics.
Let's take a call, gentlemen. Diane is calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Diane, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm a select person from Ward 2 in Portsmouth. I worked 15 hours yesterday, Saturday, opening absentee ballots. So I'm a little tired this morning. But
sure. Glad you called.
My comment is about Civics 101 and the questions that I get asked when people come in, and many people don't understand what a primary is. First of all, they tell me that they're registered as independents, and I go, no, you're registered as undeclared. We don't have an independent party here. So there's a lot of confusion about the words. And the other comment was, can I vote some Democrats, but I also want to vote in some Republicans, and no, you can only have one ballot. I'm sorry, this is a primary. So if you put a Republican name on an independent, on a Democratic ballot, the Democratic ballot will get credit for somebody voting, but that name won't go over to the Republican side. So there's a lot of confusion about people voting, how they're registered, what a primary is, and that's not completely clear. So I just wanted to mention that, because there were a lot of questions about that yesterday. Otherwise, everything went very smoothly.
I mean, I guess the good news is, Diane, people who came and were not well informed about what a primary was, maybe they're first time voters, right? So that's good. How did the absentee process work at your polling place, Diane?
It was fine. As I said, we opened a lot of the ballots on Saturday, checked to make sure they were signed, that everything was in place, and then it went very smoothly. And the other thing I noticed yesterday is that we had people, it was steady all day, as opposed to the usual burst in the morning and burst at 5 or 6 o'clock, because not that many people are out working, so they can come during the day, and they're not coming after work, so they came all day long. So I think that's because so many people are working at home right now.
And last question for you, Diane. I'm so glad you called, because again, you worked at the polls. There is some sort of confusion, maybe call it distrust, uncertainty around how those absentee ballots are counted. So when and how are they counted at your polling place in Portsmouth, Diane?
They do not enter the machine until Election Day. Absolutely, on Election Day, they get put into the counting machine. So we look at them ahead of time just to make sure that everything is in place so that we can enter them on Election Day. And we were accepting ballots. Ballots were accepted at City Hall until 5 o'clock on Election Day, 5 p.m. So people were able to actually physically bring their ballots in up until 5 p.m. Just to give us time to get them into the machines before we closed at 7.
Great to hear from you, Diane.
It went very smoothly.
Yeah, I hope you get some rest today. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And let's take another call. This is Mark in Concord. Hi, Mark. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you. And I corroborate Diane's points completely. I am the Ward 3 ballot clerk in Concord, which for people in Concord is Beaver Meadow. As I say, it's the best polling place in Concord. You can get a beer, a burger, play golf, and vote all at the same time. There's an event tent outside, and we voted in the event tent because we wanted to give as much space as possible. It made the ballots a little damp, but it really worked very well. We did exactly what Diane said about pre-processing the ballots, the absentee ballots. We had about 300 to 325 out of 850 ballots on Saturday at the community center, and that took us about an hour and a half to alphabetize and to check the affidavits. And one of the unintended consequences of that was that we found three ballots that the affidavits were not properly executed, and the city clerk had time to get in touch with those people to have them either sign the affidavit or do something to make the affidavit good so that we could process the ballot on Tuesday, as Diane said. If that had come in on Tuesday, that just would not have happened. And so that was sort of a nice unintended consequence. In terms of the absentee ballot, is exactly as Diane said. We wind up we don't open the inside ballot until the inside envelope until Tuesday. The moderator announces the names. We had highlighted all the pre-processed ones so that it was very easy for the person on the checklist to check off the actual name, because we had highlighted the name in yellow. And so that went very quickly. And we, contrary to other states, New Hampshire winds up entering the absentee ballots during the daytime. And
sure,
so they are included with the final count at the end of the day. And my final point is I started doing this back in 2016. And I, as a poll worker, and I was there from 6 in the morning till 11 o'clock last night, I resent mightily people talking about fraud. At least in Ward 3, and I will say it for the city of Concord, it does not happen. And it is offensive when people say it. And I believe the state of New Hampshire, it's all anecdotal, I think Bill Gardner and the Secretary of State's office runs an exceptionally fine operation here. It does not happen. And it's annoying, it's insulting, and it's infuriating. When people talk about fraud, it doesn't happen.
And I really appreciate your service. 6 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. I'm kind of sorry I don't live in your ward. I'm in Ward 5, because then I could have, beer, burger, and play golf.
Okay.
Good to hear from you, Mark.
Right next door.
There you go. All right. Mark, I'm going to let you go because we got to take a quick break. And I've got another election official waiting over in the eastern part of the state. But thank you so much for calling in, Mark. It's really great to hear from you. And we'll take more of your calls in just a moment. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call. Tell us how voting went for you. Give us your reaction to some of the results that we saw yesterday. And if you want to brag about your polling place, go ahead. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. We will be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, a review of Tuesday's primary elections and a preview for November. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you on how voting went in your community or what you make of who won and who lost yesterday. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook or you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with UNH professor and pollster Andy Smith and NHPR news director Dan Barrick. And with us now is Todd Selig. He's Durham's town manager. And Todd, welcome back. Great to have you.
Hi, great. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So overall, how did it go yesterday, Todd, in Durham?
It was smooth and steady. In Durham, because of the pandemic, we actively encouraged folks to come and vote absentee. We were trying to keep poll numbers down. And we took a number of steps to try to spread out in the Oyster River High School, which is our polling place. And we had tents outside for people to drop off their absentee ballots as well. And overall, it was a quieter day than we typically see. But, here's some interesting information for you. About 60% of the people who voted yesterday in Durham voted absentee.
60%.
We saw a 13% increase in total votes compared to 2 years ago in 2018. We were just under 2,700 votes cast versus about 2,400 in 2018. And, you know, all in all, it was a good day.
So where was your polling place? Was that different from last year, or was it the same?
Well,
from last time,
The Oyster River High School, as in the past, but typically we hold the state primary in the multi-purpose room, which is a much smaller room at the high school. This year, we moved the election into the gymnasium, which is probably four times the size, and we occupied space outside the gym for the same-day absentee voting process. So we were in a much larger footprint this year.
Okay, but at the same space, because we did get a couple comments from listeners whose polling places had been changed, and they went to the usual place and couldn't find it. What about student voting, Todd? You're there at the seat of UNH.
Yeah, so we had a strong turnout of students, but typically the election that really brings out the students at the University of New Hampshire who are domiciled in Durham is the presidential election. So, for example, we had about 2,700 votes in Durham yesterday. For the 2016 presidential election, we had almost 10,000 voters with 3,000
wow.
same-day registration. So those 3,000 same days are typically UNH students.
And looking ahead to November, again, as you just illustrated with those numbers, the numbers will be bigger. So this was kind of the warm-up act, right, Todd? So lessons learned for you as a town manager as you get ready for November, 8 weeks away.
Absolutely. So this was the prelude to the main event, which is the general election in November. And we really were trying to kick the tires and understand the process, get it down so that we can process large numbers of people and do it. I think we've got a good process down in Durham. People felt comfortable. Our election workers felt comfortable largely. And I think we kept people safe. So mission accomplished.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm sure it was a long day.
It was a long day. We were there till about 1 a.m. So
wow.
Anyway, I was up early this morning and then up again early this morning.
We appreciate
All
you being with us, Todd.
Voting.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Thanks so much. Have
Thanks,
a great
Todd.
Day.
Bye-bye. That's Todd Selig. Again, he's Durham's town manager. And Dan Barrick and Andy Smith, as we talk about, you know, late nights and not all the votes counted just yet. Dan, can you just remind us what is going on with this Democratic primary for governor? As you reported earlier, Dan Feltes has declared victory, but Andrew Walensky has not conceded. So how do we sort that out, Dan?
Well, we're just going to have to wait till a few more votes come in. Last I checked, there was about 90% of precincts across the state had reported their returns, with Feltes up by about 2 percentage points, which, you know, that's a fairly, you know, safe margin with only 10% of the vote left to come in. But of course, I hadn't looked since last night, so I'm not sure exactly what towns remain. Feltes late last night, I think around 11 o'clock, spoke to some supporters and essentially gave a victory speech. Walensky has said he's, you know, not ready to concede until he gets a little bit more clarity. Not entirely unusual, you know, when you've got it this close. And I think once some additional returns come in, some late reporting towns, you know, towns where the clerks might have forgot to hit send before they sent in their returns before heading out for the night, that kind of thing. So I think at this point it looks, you know, momentum's on Feltes' side, but we're just going to have to wait, you know, probably wait. I'd assume by the end of the day we'd have that resolved.
Sure. And Andy, what did your polling tell you about this race between Andrew Walensky and Dan Feltes?
Well, it showed it was going to be close. We were seeing that it was essentially a dead heat a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago. But a lot of people were undecided, which is, again, typical in a state primary. You just don't have the visibility in a state primary as you do in a general election. And you don't have that party cue to know which one of these two people you should be voting for. So the one thing in the polling that was interesting to me, and really, I think, if we have exit polls on this, which I don't think we do, but would be an indication of what happened, is that Walensky was doing better among the progressive wing of the party, which also means he was doing better among younger voters. Among people that were 18 to 34 in our poll, he was leading Feltes by 53% to 23%. But Feltus was either leading or pretty close in all of the other age categories. And one of the truisms about politics, in particular about primary elections, is young people don't vote. Older people, established voters, people who vote out of habit, are the ones who come out and vote. Saying you're going to win the elections with a lot of young people, it's a real tough thing to do, especially in a primary election.
Well, that's interesting. And Dan Barrick, you know, Andrew Walensky, Bernie Sanders supporter. So even though he's older than Dan Feltus, he was drawing that younger vote. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you saw that in the returns, as Andy Smith just mentioned. You know, Durham came in late last night, and that was a big boost of votes for Walensky late. It just wasn't quite enough to put him over the edge. But in terms of, yeah, the sort of ideological contrast, I mean, you know, there, I think a lot was made, especially by Walensky's campaign, about the, you know, sort of progressive versus mainstream or establishment divide there. Feltus, you know, serving as state Senate majority leader, essentially, you know, one of the more powerful elected officials in Concord. But I think if you actually look at the race itself, it was fought along, you know, pretty narrow ideological and policy grounds. It was really, you know, where the two candidates differed most, I'd say, was over the traditional pledge to veto broad-based sales or income tax. Walensky made a lot over his refusal to take that pledge and his willingness to contemplate any revenue sources, largely driven by his desire, his claim that it was necessary to fix school funding inequities. Feltus, you know, took the pledge, as every successful Democrat who's served as governor over the last, you know, two decades has, and over a couple of specific energy policy differences, particularly the use of willingness to rely on natural gas as part of the state's energy mix. Walensky made a lot of his opposition to essentially boil it down to one project in particular, the Granite Bridge pipeline project, which he said he opposed vehemently. Feltus supported it, although he did, you know, he does say he supports transitioning to more renewables and cleaner energy, but said, you know, that project was necessary in his eyes to help sort of transition to that cleaner future, especially for lower income folks. Those are really the two main areas policy wise where the two candidates differed. And, you know, I think Feltus had a lot more money that helped through the end. And I think Andy's analysis too about, you know, attempting in a primary election to rely on younger voters to put you over the edge, it's a tough haul. And Walensky appears to have gotten pretty close, but not quite enough to win in the nomination.
Let's take one more call, gentlemen. This is Laura and Jaffrey. Hi, Laura. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I was a poll worker yesterday at Jaffrey, and I have nothing but positive things to say. Our city clerk had everything under control. Everything was absolutely organized. The people they knew their jobs. Everything was spread out in the gym at the high school. And all the write-ins were checked and double-checked after the polls had closed. And at about 6:30, one of our mailmen came over and said, "I just found this. Someone had mailed it, and it was in our Dropbox by the, you know, the post office, and I wanted to make sure it got to you."
Wow, an absentee ballot.
An absentee ballot. They had mailed it, cause, you know, because the post office closes at 5.
Right.
And they were going over that day's mail, and he had found it, and he brought it over.
Well, Laura, thank you for calling. It's great to hear that everybody in Jaffrey is kind of on board with getting all the ballots counted. Thank you for being with us, and thanks for working at the polls. That's great.
And I'm going to do it again in November. I think it's important.
Yeah. Thank
Bye-bye.
You for being with us, Laura. Bye-bye. You know, Dan and Andy, as we close out, in terms of the issues, Andy, we focus most of this hour on the mechanics of voting, and that's great because people do have a lot of questions and concerns. But in terms of issues, what do you think New Hampshire voters are going to be saying that they care about for the November elections, Andy? What they're worrying about? You know, the number one issue for me as a voter is fill in the blank.
Yeah, I think that it's really important to point out, as Dan was saying, that in a primary election, you're really talking about splitting hairs between the candidates generally, because most Democrats support the same issues that Democrats do and Republicans vice versa. But in the general election, I think this is going to be nationalized. It's going to be an issue over Donald Trump. He's the incumbent. Typically in presidential election years, it's a referendum on thumbs up or thumbs down on the incumbent. And that's going to carry down throughout the tickets. So whoever I think wins at the top of the ticket here, with perhaps the exception of the governor's office, it's likely to go that way. The governor is a chief executive, so they kind of are independent of that. As far as the issues then, I think those are going to be the issues that are driven by the two parties. For Republicans, Trump is going to talk about economic success, and he's going to be able to, he will talk about whatever success they have out of COVID. And Democrats are going to talk about the inability or their perceptions of inability of the Trump administration to deal with COVID. And again, it's the perceptions. It's far more important than the actual issues. But the law and order message on the Democratic side, the corruption and get rid of Trump message on the Democratic side, I think are going to be overwhelmingly the two most important issues.
Well, hard to believe we are actually here in the kickoff phase, 8 weeks away from the election. And of course, NHPR will be hosting debates and covering all these issues as they roll out. And Dan Barrick, thank you very much for being with us. Congratulations on all the work your team did yesterday. There's a ton of information at nhpr.org. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Dan Barrick. He's NHPR's news director. Andy Smith, I'm sure we'll be talking again. Thank you very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
That's Andy Smith, professor of practice in UNH's Department of Political Science. He's also director of the UNH Survey Center. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brinley. Senior producer is Ellen Graham. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.